Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the show that brings you conversations that matter and a really interesting debate on veganism today, a for and against. And for more from the show, make sure you're subscribed to our newsletter. You can do that by visiting our show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There's a link if you're listening via podcast with today's show, and you'll find more resources there and ways to support us too. We'll even send you a free ebook, Why You Can Believe. It's lessons I've learned from this show over 15 years of hosting it, how to make the case for Christianity and answering some common objections. If you're able to support us, we'd love to send you that free ebook. All of those links with today's podcast, if that's how you're listening, and links, of course, to my guests who are joining me on today's show. Later on, we'll be hearing some of your feedback as well to some interesting shows on masculinity, Christian Kobe's Dumais, and also last week's show on psychedelics. That was a bit different. We'll hear what you had to say about that. Some really interesting perspectives, actually, from people who have used psychedelics in the past. That's all to come on today's program. Let's get into today's discussion.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the show, we're doing the vegan debate. Should Christians eat meat, we're asking. Now, veganism, the practice of not consuming meat, dairy, or indeed any animal product, has become an increasingly popular lifestyle choice in recent years. Vegan food options are often available in restaurants and supermarkets, and a survey in the US found a 300% increase in vegans between 2004 and 2019. That's about 3% of the population in the US, nearly 10 million people. So is veganism the ethical thing? Should Christians stop eating meat and go veggie? That's what we're asking on Unbelievable this week. And to discuss both sides of this, I'm joined by Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones. Now, Greg Boyd is no stranger to this show. He's a theologian, a church leader in the US who's a committed vegetarian. You may not have known that about Greg. He's actually transitioning to vegan. And he believes that it does reflect a life closer to God's ideal for a violence-free creation and is a healthier, more ethical choice for Christians. Joshua Jones is a church leader in the UK. He's from the States originally, though. He's the author of various books, including Elijah Men Eat Meat, though that is not, in fact, an argument for meat eating or against vegetarianism, as you'll hear. But Joshua is nevertheless a champion of low carb meat-rich diets, which he says was the key to his own health improving. So we'll hear his story as well. Our vegetarian and carnivore are ready to go. We're going to debate veganism today. Let's welcome you both. Greg and Joshua, thanks for being with me. Start with you, Greg, because it was when I was on the hunt for a suitable vegetarian or vegan that someone said, oh, did you know Greg Boyd is a vegetarian? And I don't think I'd quite realise that, even though we have spoken on various occasions. So tell us about your journey to vegetarianism, Greg, and where you're at now, as you say, you're transitioning to being vegan.
Yeah, well, thanks, Justin. I always enjoy being on here. I think this kind of dialogue is really, really good, especially in a world that's increasingly unable to have decent dialogue. It's good for Christians to model this. So, and this is the topic that I'm really excited about. So thanks for having me on. I always tell people I was a vegetarian at heart for about 10 years before I actually made the decision, because I loved eating meat. I grew up on rare steak, rare hamburger. I mean, we were just a carnivore family. So I felt increasingly uneasy with it, but it was a hard thing to kick. I get that that transition is not always easy. But finally, the core issue was I just, in my own spiritual journey, have gotten increasingly grieved by violence. And it just seems like the closer I get to, the more I get to know God, the more grieved I am just by how violence permeates every aspect of our society and of the world. And I got to the point where I didn't want anything to do with it. I felt God was calling me to, as much as possible, be free of all violence, purge my life, including my thoughts and my attitudes, my heart, from all things that are violence. And I would define violence as anything that violates the inherent worth of another. And so it was a commitment to never take human life, a commitment to not take any other life as much as possible. Now, if it's, if I'm on an island, shipwrecked on an island, and there's one bunny, and I'm starving, the bunny's got to go, okay? Or there's other situations where I think that if I'm over in Haiti, and all they have to offer is a chicken, I'm going to eat the chicken. That's hospitality. But as a general rule, I try to avoid killing anything. I try to kill insects. There's exceptions. Centipedes are just of the devil, and they've got to go. mosquitoes, same thing. But as much as I try to catch them and then set them free. And I think, the thing for me is that when you look at a cow and all you see is meat, you miss the beauty of the cow. And this choice of mine has opened my eyes to just see beauty where I didn't see it before, and in a depth I haven't seen it before. Jesus says that if you hate in your heart, it's the same as murder, and if you lust in your heart, it's the same as adultery. And so it's mostly for me an internal thing to be purging any kind of violating thoughts I have, which I found I was thoroughly polluted with. That's kind of my decision.
Very interesting. How long then has that been for you, and do you miss meat at any level?
It's been 17 years. It was 2004 when I finally made the commitment. So, yeah, 17 years. I don't miss meat. I don't. In fact, it kind of grosses me out. when I see someone just devouring a steak, I have to kind of do a mental thing to not, I just cringe. It just bugs me. But, I'm not tempted at all. And the thing is, in 2004... becoming a vegetarian felt like quite a sacrifice, probably because it was new to me. But the vegetarian industry has gotten so good at producing it's not hard at all. I mean, there's this frozen foods are, your options are many. And so it's even hard to feel self-righteous anymore. It really is just a bummer.
Well, let's talk to you now, Joshua. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I think, as I said, you're, you used to be in the US, you're now based in the UK, you're a church leader there, you're a fan of meat, so do you find that church and meat go together? Are you do you proselytize for meat as well as for God?
Well, I'm a big fan of people being free to eat what they want, and if they enjoy and their bodies and their health thrive on animal products, that's fantastic. If they eat more plant-based and their health is doing well and they're happy and they're giving thanks to God, that's what I'm really for. I'm for eating thankfully and freely and people not being judgmental towards one another. And I really appreciate Greg's even the correspondence leading up to this discussion. I've dealt with some feisty vegans in my time that aren't only vegan, but think everyone else should be too. And of course, there are some carnivores who feel the same way. I don't go around proselytizing for meat, but certainly within my home, there's a lot of animal products to be eaten.
So what kind of interactions have you had with vegans? What's been your sense of the way the vegans you meet, maybe online, have carried themselves and their arguments?
Well, of course, I mean, I jest a little bit, but I have some friends, other missionaries, people in ministry who are either vegetarian or vegan. They're fine people. They're wonderful people. What maybe motivated me to blog more about this? And right now, you know, my book's out, Meat, a Brief Biblical Theology, is out there. It's more a defense of people who, want to eat animal products and who enjoy steak and hamburgers and yogurt and, milk and these different things, and want to be able to enjoy this without feeling ashamed, like they're doing something wrong or dirty. I think it was a few years ago when, you know, there's a lot of people in the media really highlighting veganism, which for some people might have been great, but then other people almost whispered, had to kind of, you know, whenever they mentioned that they had a hamburger for lunch, they kind of looked over to their shoulder, make sure nobody was looking, like they just watched a dirty movie or something. And so I was wanting to come to the defense of, you know, not necessarily pure carnivores who eat nothing but meat, but people who enjoy meat as part of a diet, and just defend that this is part of God's creation and to be consumed with thanksgiving.
So what about your own experience with eating meat? Because you're actually on quite a meat-rich diet. You think that that's quite a healthy option in some ways, even though the received wisdom for a long time has been, you know, we should cut down on our meat, we should cut down on fat, we should, you know, have everything as, you know, skinny as possible. You take a different view to that, don't you?
Well, I can just share my own journey, what worked for my health and my body. And of course, you know, different people's, their bodies react differently to different foods. So when I was in my mid to late 20s, my health started taking a downward turn. And this was everything from weight gain to lots of dental issues, constantly having cavities, brain fog, fatigue, numerous issues. I went to a doctor, even switched doctors for a while. They put me on statins and said, well, maybe my cholesterol's too high. I was 27 years old, and, you know, they put me on statins for the rest of my life when I was 27. So they got me on make sure you're eating five a day and the food pyramid. And, you know, they're doing everything that the NHS, you know, bless them, and the British medical system, following the standard advice. But for me, it wasn't working. I was not feeling better. I was continuing to have health issues. And one day my wife comes home, I'm thinking about 29, 30 years old at the time. And she had been at one of these moms and tots group with, you know, our little kids. And she had met some traditional Catholic lady who was into some, I don't even know what the movement was, but she made some comment that, you know, this lady who appeared very healthy apparently eat butter and red meat all the time. Now, butter and red meat, of course, were two of those things that were I had not really touched for about 3-4 years, and was, you know, really off that, and really even longer than 3-4 years. I'd eaten very little of that. And she challenged me to, you know, this lady, through conversation with my wife, kind of loaned her a book. And I said, you know what, my health is just so bad right now. Why not? Let me try this for 2 months. And what I mean by this was eating in a more traditional way. So a lot of modern foods, so refined grains, sugars, vegetable oils, things of this nature, just get rid of them. If it's been invented in the last 100 years, get rid of it. And go back to eating, you know, bacon and steak. And it wasn't a carnivore diet per se. I was still eating many traditional foods, potatoes and whatnot. But yeah, really switched the way I ate. And the first week was horrible. I had withdrawals. I was shaking. Getting off sugar and getting off white flour, refined grains. It was like a drug addict coming off these really processed carbs, you know. I remember on day 4, I was trying to write, doing sermon prep, and my hand was shaking, and the pen was shaking in my hand. I actually dreamt that night of eating shortbread, which I don't know how common that is in America right now, but very often for tea breaks, you'll have a little piece of shortbread to go with your tea. And I've been 5 whole days without shortbread. And my body was like, I was drooling and salivating in my sleep, just thinking about, you know, the shortbread. I stuck with it. The first week, maybe 10 days, was really rough. You know, changing your diet radically like that, it shakes up your body. But after that 10 days, all of a sudden it's like this fog lifted. And I began to wake up with more energy. About 2, 3, 4 weeks into it, my skin began to change complexion. I used to be very pasty white, and all of a sudden more of a yellowish, reddish undertones, like maybe, I don't know if it comes across the video, but my skin color began to change, and I found I just had more mental clarity, more energy, and I've experimented with different things since then. I've tried keto and paleo, and certainly carnivore has been a big part of that journey. I'm not a strict carnivore. I do eat fruit. Fruit's a regular part of my diet. But most every meal is based around animal products. 80% of my calories come through animal products. Right. Meat, yeah. But also dairy. Today I stopped by a local farmer where I buy a lot of raw milk. The cow was just milked this morning, and I was able to haul off several gallons of this raw milk straight from the cow. Fantastic. I just guzzle this stuff. And it's done great wonders for my health. Haven't had dental problems for about 10 years, and me and my family do really well on this. And we don't say that's for everyone, but it's certainly been a big help for us.
Well, as I say, obviously it's worked for you. And it's interesting because on the one hand, as you've seen the growth of the sort of the vegan lifestyle products, you've also got on the other end of that extreme, I've heard people like Jordan Peterson and his daughter Michaela Peterson, you know, extolling the wonders of, you know, almost exclusively meat diets and red meat especially and that sort of thing. So there's always, I suppose, you know, the different ends of these spectrums, aren't there? Okay, well, there you go, Greg. Obviously, Joshua, big fan of the meat, and actually says from a health point of view, you know, turning back to animal products and kind of ditching some of the more processed foods has been a big help for him. Before we get into the sort of the ethical and if you like, biblical issues around this, though, you're not kind of, in a sense, as dogmatic, it sounds, as some vegans arguably are, Greg. You do see that there's an issue of conscience here, ultimately.
Yeah, I think it's very explicit in the New Testament. If Paul says, in 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy, he's listing the doctrine of demons, and one of them, he says, the forbidding of meat. So it's the New Testament is against getting legalistic about this. And it's explicitly mentioned in Romans 14. You know, for some people are okay with eating this meat, other people not. Yeah, that's where I understand the passion of the vegans who are, you know, activists, and everyone should be this. And I share a lot of their convictions and a lot of their passion, but the New Testament is, I think, really clear that this is not an issue that any brother should be judging another brother on or anything of the sort.
I guess the reason that maybe a lot of Christians would say, though, we're living in very different times to the New Testament, the way meat is produced, farmed, etc. You know, it was a far more natural way. You know, people were a lot more in touch, at least, with the food sources in Jesus's day.
I would never look down on anyone for eating meat, having different food choices than I have. There are, I think, principles that all Christians should be thinking about. So that's what I kind of advocate, is we reflect on this. We're all called to have dominion and to, you know, take responsibility for the earth and the animal kingdom. And so flushing that out, you know, I'm concerned that people think this through, think about, like, what the impact their food choices and lifestyle choices in general, the impact it has on animals, and the impact it has on the environment. Those are, I think, things that we should all be thinking about.
And what, just sketch out for us briefly, and I'll let Joshua respond, what you think the impact is on animals and the environment in terms of the way we do currently rear and eat animal products.
Yeah, well, this wasn't my driving reason for becoming a vegetarian, though having become it, now I find other reasons to support it and stuff. One of them being health benefits. My cholesterol just went way down. I had high cholesterol before I became a vegetarian, and that disappeared. And I didn't become a vegetarian for that reason, but that's a nice fringe benefit. But I'm really concerned with the industrial farm industry. I have more trouble with people supporting the industrial farm industry than I have with somebody eating meat from a local farm. Like you see, you got your milk from a local place where, you know, they can live a natural existence. And so for me, what I've learned about industrial farms is that a lot of those animals don't have anything natural about them. They live in an artificial, everything like a pig being stuck in an industrial farm. There's nothing natural there. They're meant to be grazing and all this other stuff, and they're not allowed to do that. And so I have no problem with folks who get their meat from a local farm where animals can live a natural existence. I still wouldn't eat that meat, but I think that's a much better choice than supporting the industrial farm industry.
So there are better choices when it comes to meeting. I mean, would you agree with that, Joshua? Do you have any concerns yourself about the way that, you know, the industry happens in terms of the way meat is processed and reared and so on?
Yeah, so, I mean, this isn't going to be much of a debate because I just agreed with everything Greg said on that point. And many carnivores and people who are really into this lifestyle are some of the strongest proponents of regenerative farming practices because, you know, they're particular about their meat. They want good quality meat. They don't want meat that's just been stuffed in lots but been free to graze. So some of the biggest passionate people for reform in the whole industrialization of farming are certainly, you know, carnivores. You know, regenerative farming is, you know, if you're unfamiliar with the term and all that regenerative farming implies, it'd be a great thing to Google, look up on YouTube, familiarize yourself with it. It's that returning to pre-World War II practices. And I would highlight, though, it's not just industrial livestock. It is also industrial agriculture. You know, the monocropping of these huge fields, you know, because you have these giant combines to harvest, you know, giant fields of soy or corn, and year after year, there's no crop rotation, there's no ecosystem for animals to be with the, you know, the plants and to fertilize it naturally. It's bad news for meat and it's bad news for plants. So whether you're a vegan or a carnivore, the whole industrial movement is, you know, it's been bad news on both sides of this. And I would be all for reform, as I think Greg would too.
Though Greg, I do usually hear vegans making the case that it is a more environmentally friendly option to go vegan. So do you have a view on that in terms of the actual impact on the planet itself of less animal, you know, farming and so on?
Yeah, I don't know if Joshua would agree with this or not, but what I've read, and I haven't read on this topic for, I was big into it for a couple of years when I first started. Now I haven't kind of left it behind. But as I recall, in fact, there was a study that was done, I think, 2019 that concluded that supporting animals being raised for food take three times more resources than it takes three times more resources to support a meat eating diet than it does a vegetarian diet. And that's largely about the industrial farms. And also about the pollution, the methane gas and all that has done. I had read this one study that showed that argued that the amount of greenhouse gases emitted by farm animals on industrial farms was greater than that of cars and trucks worldwide. And so I think it does leave a bigger negative imprint when done in industrial farms.
What do you say to that particular environmental argument, Joshua?
Yeah, so I got a few things. So I'm going to respond not just to Greg, but maybe also to some other, maybe I'll call them more feisty vegans that I've encountered that maybe have been a little more aggressive in their argumentation than a nice guy like Greg is being. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, not this whole thing of violence and not wanting to, you know, kill an animal so that I can eat. My challenge to that, you know, would be, well, you know, what are we eating? Because in the age of industrialized farming, there's blood on your plate no matter what you eat. If I wanted to be a strict carnivore and eat nothing but beef and water, I could put a cow in the field behind me. Now that cow would walk on the hills and graze with, you know, there are field mice there, rabbits, moles, trees. And at the end of the year, you'd butcher the cow and, you know, one cow would die to feed me for, I don't know what, 6 months, 9 months, a year. I'm not sure. It might depend on the size of my appetite or the size of the cow. But to take that field and make it a field to grow soy or to grow corn, you have to use some large industrial machinery first to flatten the field, then a lot of machinery to take out all the rocks. Plus, how many mice are you killing? How many rabbits are you killing? How many moles are you killing? How much trees? I mean, to make these huge monoculture fields, you have to kill all the animals that lived in that field. So when you're having that soy burger or that corn or whatever, you know, to get those giant fields that that comes from, you're having to destroy some ecosystems and some habitats to make space for grains and crops of that sort. That's the industrial age we live in. Now, I don't think it has to be that way, whether you're vegan or vegetarian or carnivore. I said regenerative farming. I think there is a better way. I think Greg would agree with me. But to think that I can escape violence just by not eating meat or animal products, the system's a little more complicated than that.
Okay, Greg, respond.
I agree with that. But I would want to have as little of that as possible. The same is true as money. I don't think we have a guiltless dollar in our wallet. But in terms of my personal choices, I want to be living as justly as possible, as guileless as possible. And so, yeah, there's inevitable, you know, think of all the insects that got killed when you plow that field and whatever. So that is what it is until we get better regenerative farming practices. But as a personal, as a kingdom person, I want to be as free of that as possible and minimize it as much as possible, have as small an impact, negative impact on the environment as possible. That's why I think it's really good that all kingdom people, since we're called to be good stewards of the earth and the animal kingdom, need to be asking the question, it's a question that most people don't ask, and that is, what impact is my food choices here? What did the animal have to go through before to get on my plate? And what did the vegetable have to go through to get on my plate? I mean, and to make choices, buying locally is greatly reduces your imprint and those kind of things.
Yeah, so for, I don't know what it is worldwide, but the current statistics in the United States are that for carbon emissions, 3.5% comes from livestock, 4% comes from agriculture. By comparison, 11% comes from pharmaceuticals. But again, a lot of this is about the industrialization, whether you're eating plants or animals. The regenerative, you know, one thing that I would encourage all our listeners to look up is the regenerative farm movement, where many of these farms, probably what the big example that's often held up is the big ranch in Georgia, the White Oaks farm there, where they actually have a negative carbon emission. It's actually the carbon is sequestered and going back into the ground just through their different methods of how they deal with both plants and pigs and cattle. And, you know, it's by comparison to industrial farming and livestock, very friendly. You know, and now carbon emissions isn't my field. It's not, I don't think it's Greg's field. And so I'd love to stick this close to the Bible teaching on this and not pretend to be an expert on all things carbon. But I know there's a big difference between how these things are actually raised.
After a short break, we'll see if Greg wants to come back on that. But I do want to turn as well to the biblical aspect of this, and that's what we'll do in the next segment of today's show. We're talking about veganism today. Should Christians eat meat? My guests are Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. We're talking about veganism today. Quite a few people have asked for this in the last few years, a debate on Unbelievable on veganism. Should Christians eat meat? Though I haven't selected two people with, you know, who are poles apart in terms of their approach to this. Greg Boyd is a vegetarian transitioning to vegan, but says he's not, you know, militaristic about it, and there will be some circumstances where he would eat meat if necessary. And likewise, he sees it a matter of conscience. However, overall, he does see that there is an ethical case and a biblical case for choosing not to eat meat, to live as violence-free as possible, as he sees it. Joshua Jones, church leader here in the UK, but from the US himself, is our carnivore on today's show, arguing for the value of eating the way that humans have for millennia when it comes to meat, but doing it in a responsible way, obviously. So we've covered a little bit, we've grazed the surface at least, of some of the environmental health issues and so on. But let's turn to the biblical issues, Greg and Joshua, if you would. I mean, Greg, this for you, I think, comes down ultimately to a vision of what the new creation is and how Christians are supposed to be setting an example and living into that vision of new creation. Is it your view then, Greg, that if you like, in the beginning, you know, it was a vegetarian situation, and that's the vision for the new creation that actually, you know, and I've heard lots of people reference, you know, the lion, the lamb laying down with the lion and so on as a vision of that sort of non-violent, non-death kind of vision. What's your take on all of this, though?
Yeah, I'm struck by the lion Genesis, where however you literal, figurative, you know, there's a million different ways of interpreting this, but Genesis 1:30, where he says, I give the plants vegetation for everything to eat, the birds of the air, the animals, for people. And it seems like I think that's kind of God's original ideal for creation, was that it'd be entirely free of violence. And I'm impressed with then the eschatological visions that you find several times throughout Scripture, Isaiah 11 being the one that you just referenced, where the lion will lay down the lamb. And there's this, God's shalom pervades the whole creation. There's no violence in the whole creation. The child will play with the cobra. And I'm sure, you know, those are metaphors, but they point towards something. And one of the main tasks of kingdom people, as I understand it, is that we are to be the first fruits. We're called that three different times in the New Testament. The first fruits of the coming creation. And first fruits were always, you know, in the Old Testament, they were the fruit that ripened early, and they were picked and then consecrated to God as a way of saying, we trust you for the rest of the harvest, and as a sign that the harvest is coming, God will keep his promise. So we're called to be early fruit. In a world of unripened fruit, we're to be the ripened fruit, to put on display something of the future. And so an ethical kind of principle that I teach a lot is that all other things being equal, if you'll be doing it in heaven, do it now. And if you won't be doing it in heaven, don't do it now. To be the already in a world that's not yet. And so if there won't be any violence in heaven in the future coming kingdom, all other things being equal, that's what I want to strive for now as much as possible, to put that on display. So I think that God's ideal is nonviolence. We're called to be the already and not yet, and put it on display.
So will we all be vegans in heaven, Joshua, anyway, and should we try for it now?
Well, I mean, if we were to take this type of reasoning and saying, you know, because we did it in Eden, or that we will be doing it in heaven, and therefore Christians should model either what we did in Eden or what we'll be doing in heaven, I'm just wondering how far we're willing to take that. I mean, Adam and Eve were walking around naked without any clothes.
Go for it, baby.
You know, I don't know, is that something we should, as Christians, be trying to get back to? Also, the whole thing, well, if you're not going to be doing it in heaven, well, there's no marriage in heaven. Should we all embrace a celibate lifestyle and forego marriage? Should Christian women not expect to have pains in childbirth? And so if we were to take this outside of the discussion on meat and begin to apply it to many other things, I think all of us would probably agree, yeah, that's maybe not such a smart idea. You know, there really will be quite a difference between existence in heaven and existence in Eden. That's just not appropriate for this era. As far as what, you know, the Bible says about what heaven will be like, Greg's completely right. And I agree with him that a lot of this language is metaphorical. So it is hard to know. But there are metaphors, too, that might give us an indication that we do eat meat. I think it's Isaiah 25, that great image of the table of the Lord that'll be stretched out when death is conquered and God sets his table. He talks about, I forget which verse exactly in 25, maybe verse 6 or 7, where it talks about, you know, fatty meats and you'll be eating the marrow. You know, that's a picture of heaven. So there is some eschatological image. I mean, even the whole land of milk and honey, you know, those are both animal products. A strict vegan would never eat honey because it comes from bees or milk, you know. So there is imagery that are connected with animal products that are eschatological in nature. But I agree, some of it is metaphorical.
And the other thing I would add, I suppose, Greg, the obvious thing is Jesus ate meat. You know, he celebrated the Passover. He ate the lamb. So if Jesus is our model, then he certainly was not a vegan. Where do you go with all of these issues?
Well, that's why I qualified what I said as much as possible. I mean, in terms of ideals to strive for. And especially, I think, in terms of, and we could get into parsing, like, should we go nude, or should we, you know, all those kind of things. But in terms of, like, our loving stance, I think it's the main thing is the love and the compassion, developing that kind of a character. So I think being merciful and compassionate towards animals, which, you know, the Bible talks a lot about God's compassion towards animals. It kind of sets that in a different category than whether we'll wear clothes or not, or whether we should be wearing clothes now, which I would strongly recommend we continue doing. I mean, there's certain things we've got to accommodate in the here and now. So we live in the already not yet kind of tension ourselves. So as much as possible. And so there are things that trump and I always have to, whenever I say Trump, I have to like qualify myself now, since we've, it's like, it conjures up images. We got to get a different word. There's things that are more important than being a vegetarian. Hospitality, like when Jesus sends out the 70. You know, these are kosher Jews, and yet he tells them, eat whatever they set before you. Because the human connectedness is more important than your particular diet. That's why after the resurrection, Jesus has fish with them. And then he passes through a wall, which I can't figure out what happens to the fish he just ate. I think so. Fellowship is a more important consideration. But all other things being equal, when it's possible, and it's not contrary to kingdom hospitality and all those other things, I think striving for an ideal of nonviolence. For me, that was just an essential part of my call. That's the part of the not yet that I want to be already-ing as much as possible.
Go ahead, Joshua.
Yeah, so I agree in principle, but maybe just not application with Greg. You know, when God really specifically pronounces the famous meat verses there in Genesis chapter 9, where God says, everything that moves about, you know, I give you for food, and God, you know, blesses and permits mankind to eat meat, he then does give it a qualification. And it is one of mercy and kindness and compassion. And that is, you're not to eat it like the other apex predators out there. You know, us humans, we're at the top of the food chain, up there with lions and great white sharks and everything. We kind of dominate the top of the food chain, and we sometimes have to compete with certain big animals, whether they're going to eat us or we're going to eat them. But we're not to eat meat the way these other apex predators do. You know, a lion will just go leap on an antelope and begin to eat it before it's dead. We are not to eat meat, it says, with the lifeblood still in it, which many commentators throughout the years have said, you know, you don't eat an animal while it's still alive. You must humanely kill it. You know, there is a kosher meat is killed in the most humane way possible, where there's minimal pain, minimal suffering, and an animal raised by a human in a kosher farm, in a farm by a righteous animal, will suffer a quicker, easier death than if left out in the wild. To when they get old, to suffer old age, or really to be eaten by other animals. So we are not to eat meat like the other animals do. There is to be. So my application for how I would want to extend mercy to nature and to the animal kingdom would come through, hey, let's make sure that the animal has a better life grazing in a farmer's field and an easier death than if that animal was in the wild competing with other animals.
So is what you're saying in that sense, Joshua, that for all Greg's, what he says about not wanting violence or to live in a less violent world by not choosing to eat meat, mm-hmm. that actually the violence is there anyway, and it's actually up to humans what level of violence is involved with the way we do actually consume the meat that we eat?
We should not be as violent to animals as animals are to other animals. That's part of our humanity. That's part of our image of God.
I agree with that. I'm just curious, Joshua, though, do you drain the blood? Because that's part of the Genesis 9 covenant that was supposed to be an everlasting covenant that you have to drain the blood out. In Acts 15, when they were trying to figure out how the Jews and Gentiles get along, one of the requirements was to make sure that you're not eating the blood. The meat has to be kosher. How do you process that?
Yeah, so there are a number of different commentators who, you know, even Jewish and Christian, who talk about all that that implies, the removal of the blood and what is properly kosher meat. And, you know, in Islam, they have something similar with halal. But one thing everybody is agreed on is, you know, there were pagan practices where you would eat part of the animal while it was still alive. And for a Christian or a Jew, you know, that is, you know, strictly forbidden. The animal should die humanely. Now, how much blood is drained out afterwards, or if it's just qualifying life blood versus blood, there's some debate on all that was implied in Genesis 9. But at the very least, you know, these were common pagan practices to eat meat like other animals would eat meat. And we are not to do that.
All right. What do you make of, after the flood, God enters into this covenant, and now he recites the first covenant. It has very similar terms, although he makes an allowance, whereas before he said, I give you all the vegetation, you and the animals, everything else for food. Now he says, I allow you to eat this meat. But it seems to me that that's an accommodation. It's like, given the circumstance of the world, for whatever reasons, God now is allowing something that wasn't allowed earlier. How do you read that?
Yeah, a couple of things to point out. One is that in Genesis 1 and 2, in the pre-fall conditions, God never he never forbids the eating of meat. He puts them in a garden. He says, you can eat fruit. And actually, I would argue that our first parents, depending on how literal, you know, you take the symbolism of Genesis 1 and 2, stronger case would be argued that if anything, they were fruititarians, not so much vegetarians, you know, that it was the plants bearing the seeds within them. So, you know, they were maybe eating fruit. But it's never, meat is never forbidden. It's, you know, if I have someone over my house and I have maybe baked a giant turkey, and a turkey is at the center of the table, and I say, you know, I've made a big turkey, you know, eat all you want. You know, you're free to eat all the turkey you want. In saying you're free to eat all the turkey you want, I'm not necessarily saying they can't also have a glass of milk or they couldn't eat an apple. So God did forbid something, but the only thing that was forbidden was the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's the only thing that was explicitly forbidden. God never said, thou shalt not eat meat. When you get then to Genesis 4, you have two brothers, one of which is in the agriculture business and one seems to be in livestock. That's, you know, Cain and Abel. What was Abel doing as a shepherd? When he offered up his sacrifice, Abel offered up meat, you know, whereas Cain offered up the vegetables. And by the way, I'm not trying to, I'm not saying people who are vegetarian are more like Cain. I'm simply saying that practice then, shepherding and having meat to offer up, was already there immediately after the fall. That was long before Noah. So it seems like meat eating, at least for the righteous Abel, you know, God did not condemn Abel. What are you doing being a shepherd? What are you doing offering me meat? It seemed to already be part of the situation. God never condemns Abel for that.
It's a tree that doesn't condemn it.
So yeah, I don't think it's just an accommodation. I said, you know, he affirms it. It's almost a say, hey, everything that moves, you are free to eat. And yeah, so I think there's some room for interpretation.
Where does God affirm that?
There in Genesis 9, you are free to eat everything that moves about. You know, he doesn't. I'm not sure he's reluctantly saying it. Well, okay, I don't want you to do it, but maybe. I mean, an instance of that would be like the Old Testament permission on divorce, where God says, "I really don't want you to do it, but you're really hard of heart, so I'll kind of allow it." You know, you don't really get that in the Old Testament provision of, you know, for meat. I don't see. God provides me. Jesus provides, multiplies the fishes, you know, and gives it to people. He doesn't do that with divorce or other things where there's a permission, but kind of a reluctant permission.
Mm. So in your reading, I just to make sure I'm hearing you clearly, when God says, I give the vegetation, seeds of the plants for all the birds and for everything that moves in the ground, all that, the implicit text is, and I also give them to each other to eat. That your analogy would lead to that kind of a assessment that he just left out saying, oh, and by the way, you can eat each other, eat the animals, whatever. that just seems a little bit stretched. And it's true that Abel, he doesn't condemn Abel for offering this food, but it's also true that he didn't command them to offer. In fact, he doesn't command them to make sacrifices. That's something they start doing. They start doing a lot of things that he didn't command. And it seems to me that when, you know, God accommodates a lot of things in the Bible, and when he accommodates things, he never does this, well, I'd rather not, but I'm going to have to. Oh, he does in the case of divorce, but like with polygamy, he just accommodates it, and he doesn't approve of it, but he doesn't go around. It's like it's such a common practice. He works with that system to move it in a certain direction.
Sure. Well, yes and no. I mean, God doesn't specifically in a direct way, but all the stories of polygamy in the Old Testament, you know, they usually end bad. It was like the guy wanted to take a second wife. And, you know, the story kind of goes downhill from there. Abraham takes Hagar. It goes downhill. David takes too many wives. And Solomon, it leaves to paganism. You know, the beginning there of Samuel, there's the story of Hannah. She's the second wife. And you get the impression the husband's not having a great time with these wives, fighting all the time. Jacob has four wives. They're constantly pregnant. He's miserable. He says, my days have been evil, and you know, they're having a rough time. So by contrast, God actively provides meat sometimes in miraculous ways, you know, where it's hard not to take that as an affirmation where God does more than just allow it, but is in a miraculous way providing for it.
Well, there is, you know, 2 Samuel 12, where, you know, after David does it up with Bathsheba, and then sends Nathan there, and he says, the Lord, you know, gave you all these wives. Why'd you have to go after her? If you provided for you, now this judgment's coming on you. And so even though that's not an ideal, God works within the limitations of that culture. And I'm the first to say that.
Yeah.
In many cultures, in fact, most cultures traditionally, I don't think vegetarian was much of an option. Although you find incredible examples of it, like Pythagoras in the 6th century. It's amazing. But on the whole, some would even argue it's a matter of privilege to be able to have this debate. you know, a lot of the world, that they don't have a lot of food options.
I mean, it should be pointed out that, you know, most of the world's vegans are involuntary vegans. You know, there's 1 billion people out there who are vegans because they're in impoverished conditions and they can't afford to get meat. And they certainly can't afford the nice supplementation for vitamin B12, vitamin D3, some of these other things that Western vegans who, you know, eat all plant products but get these nice supplements, to be able to eat meat and animal products. It's something most of the world enjoys, but, you know, the poorest 10%, they're vegan, but they don't want to be.
Arguably, that could be another sort of argument that Joshua is making there, Greg, for the naturalness, if you like, of eating meat. It is part of a balanced diet to give you all the vitamins, nutrients you need. As a vegetarian yourself, do you have to supplement because you're not eating any animal products with you know, vitamins and so on?
No, I've had getting enough protein on a plant diet. I haven't found to be that hard at all. I mean, there's all these nuts and stuff you can have that provide that. It hasn't been. The only supplement I take is Tarmanac or whatever, because it's anti-inflammatory. But otherwise, it's been. I mean, there's people, you know, Matthew Scully, who wrote the book Dominion, which is, I think, one of the best books out there on merciful treatment of animals. The guy was a bodybuilder. He could press, like, I think he said 355, and he was vegetarian, but ripped. But I don't leverage much on that, because what I found is that you can be healthy or unhealthy as a meat eater or as a vegetarian. You know, just because you're vegetarian or vegan doesn't mean that you're healthier. I think all other things being equal, it's a healthier diet. But you got to be making sure that you're covering your bases there, as well as with meat. I think that if you're a meat eater, you got to make sure that you're getting, you know, your roughage and all sorts of other things. So I don't leverage much
sure,
on that.
Sure. Just before we come back to Joshua, Greg, you mentioned the incident of Jesus eating fish in his resurrection body. And some have argued that that does show categorically that vegetarianism isn't necessarily going to be part of the new creation if Jesus is eating fish. What do you say to that particular argument?
Well, it's a good argument. But I just have trouble believing that we'll be killing anything in heaven. That the final state of affairs, the perfection of creation, the culmination of it, will still include killing. John says death will be no more. I mean, death is the enemy. And I take that to be a global thing. Now, can I conceive of how that's going to work? Nope, I can't conceive of it. But I can't conceive of how my body's going to be transformed. You know, so there's continuity in the next life, but there's also radical discontinuity. There'll be a new heaven and a new earth. So I don't know how it will work, but I just can't imagine there being killing in heaven. Here, it's a necessity sometimes, but I don't see that as being eternal state of affairs.
What do you make of that, Joshua? Do you think there will be actually killing in the new creation, because there will still be meat and animal products?
Well, I mean, are plants alive?
Yeah, they're not sentient, though.
You know? So, I mean, you know, a plant has to die. I know they're not sentient and not conscious of pain in the same way humans and animals are, but, you know, there would still be a living thing then that gets killed. I think, you know, when we get to wondering what the new heavens and the new earth is going to be like, we're getting into an area of speculation that I don't think the Bible is entirely clear. I did point out the metaphorical description in Isaiah 25, how it does include meat. But, you know, I'm open to that. That might be metaphorical. So I would say I don't know for sure whether there'll be meat there or not, or if there is meat, if God provides it in some sort of supernatural way. It may not even be necessary. I mean, Jesus' resurrected body walked through walls, floated to heaven. There will be eating in heaven. There's this great picture of heaven being like a banquet, but will we need food in the same way in our resurrected bodies? You know, I don't know. I feel like we're getting into a lot of speculation.
I agree.
We are. I mean, but at the center of all of this, in a sense, regardless of exactly what happens in the new creation, is I think Greg's sense that killing an animal is wrong at some level. There is just something that is violent about it. Presumably, you just disagree ultimately that there is anything wrong with killing an animal for this particular purpose. There are obviously worse ways of killing an animal, but that humans have a special privilege to be able to have that kind of dominion, if you like, Joshua, over the animal kingdom, which gives us the right to raise and slaughter animals.
So, I mean, will that apply also to other animals? You know, there are some animals whose digestive system is explicitly carnivore. They're not like us. We're omnivores. We can go back and forth between plants and, meat. But some animals, just the way they're designed, is specifically to, you know, eat insects or to eat other animals. In the new creation, will they continue to eat insects? Will they continue to eat smaller animals? Will God give them whole new digestive systems? Are animals allowed to eat other animals in the new creation? We don't know.
Yeah,
this could get into tall weeds, but if we're going to go down a notch further on this, we'd ask about to what degree is nature as we now have it a reflective of God's original plan for nature, and to what degree is it corrupted? And I've elsewhere argued that the fact that, you know, Jesus, when he comes upon all these infirmities, he and the gospel authors diagnose it as being something that is not of God. They're afflicted. He treats them as victims. But those are things that we would just call natural evil today. Like, you know, the lady with scoliosis, that happens given the laws of nature as they are now. But if Jesus diagnoses it as being something demonic, that tells me that the laws of nature as they are now are not necessarily identical to the laws which God really originally created. So go ahead.
I'd say what our resurrected body will need to function does not necessarily correlate with what our body, our unresurrected body here, it needs to function.
Absolutely.
We don't know. And so the idea that, well, in heaven we'll be doing this or in heaven we'll be doing that, therefore we should try to do it. You know, all sorts of different groups have speculated to that, and sometimes that's led some groups to mass celibacy or could lead to, you know, different lifestyle choices, which short of the resurrection of the dead, maybe aren't that practical, let's say. So just to say we do it, you know, in the new heavens and the new earth with our resurrected bodies, and I don't know if that's necessarily maybe the strongest argument, therefore, for adopting a vegan lifestyle. I think maybe some of your other arguments were stronger.
Well, it's specific it's predicated on the conviction that the kingdom of God will be free of violence. And it'll be free of violence because of the love and compassion, the non-necessity of killing, and the love and compassion that we reflect towards the earth and the animal kingdom, which was our first mandate. I mean, this is an important topic because our first mandate in the Bible was to have dominion and to reflect God's character in the way that we do that. And he has compassion on the animals and provides for them, and so that's one of our jobs. But I think that the final state will be one that's free of violence and full of love. And that's what I want to incarnate as much as possible. There's all sorts of things we have to accommodate here and now just because of this fallen physicality that we have. But that core attitude is the one that is the most important to me. Am I heavenly in terms of my attitude towards the earth and the animal kingdom?
We'll come back to this and allow you a response, Joshua. We're just going to go into the final part of our show in just a moment. We're debating veganism today. Really interesting discussion. We've been taking it on a biblical trajectory with my guests, Greg Boyd and Joshua D. Jones, in this last segment. And we'll conclude our conversation in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. If you enjoy the show, then why not tell others about it? And if you're listening via podcast, rate and review us. That helps other people to discover the show. Thanks for Mike, who's been a long-term friend of the show, for getting in touch. Mike Rand, who says, "Hope you're in fine fettle, Justin. I don't know if you're aware, but Jack Spong passed away on the 12th of September. He reached his 90th birthday in June, and I managed to get a congratulatory email to him at that time. I know he was not in line with the traditional Christian church teachings, but he had a big influence on me by encouraging me to believe in God without necessarily accepting the literal nature of the Bible." Mike came on my show several years ago now to discuss being an agnostic, and obviously found Jack Spong, who certainly has always been on the very liberal end of the Christian spectrum, helpful in his journey. I had Jack Spong on years and years ago now, and we may well use it for a classic replay, debating a more conservative Christian perspective. But thanks for getting in touch, Mike. I hadn't actually heard that news that he had passed away, but it's good of you to remind us of that. Thank you for being in touch. Coming up next week on the show, another ethical debate for you. Should those who are terminally ill or in chronic pain be allowed to end their lives with the help of doctors? There's a new bill on euthanasia, or assisted dying, as it's also called, being debated soon in Parliament here in the UK. We're going to be looking at that from both sides. Rabbi Jonathan Remain is part of the Dignity in Dying Religious Alliance, and he believes people should be given the right to end their own life. Mark Pickering is the head of the Christian Medical Fellowship, and he says assisted dying is not good for patients or for the medical staff being asked to facilitate it. So that's next week, the ethical debate that we'll be doing for you next time. Later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, on The Profile, Taylor Schumann is an author and activist on gun control from the US, and her book When Thoughts and Prayers Aren't Enough tells her own story of being a shooting survivor and her journey into the realities of gun violence. But it's a two-parter on The Profile. In the second half, I'll be joined by Mark Vernon, looking at the influence of Dante's Divine Comedy 700 years on from his death. So that's both Taylor Schumann and Mark Vernon on The Profile tonight, and on its own Profile podcast. We'll hear your feedback a little later on in today's show. Right now, let's get into the final part of today's discussion. So, concluding our discussion today on veganism, it's our big vegan debate: should Christians eat meat? Though it's really quite moderate, really, in many ways. I could have had probably a more, if you like, extreme vegan perspective on than Greg Boyd. Greg Boyd, though, says he is transitioning to vegan, and he believes that is the best ethical, as far as he can see, way to be a Christian in the world today. though he does not, you know, he won't be bashing down any doors to turn anyone forcibly vegan, though I'm sure most vegan activists wouldn't do that anyway. But nonetheless, there has been differences of opinion between you both. I mean, at a very banal, simplistic level, Greg, one of the most obvious reasons why people don't choose to be vegetarian or vegan is just they love the taste of meat. They love the way they love a hot dog. They couldn't imagine life without a T-bone steak, you know. And I can imagine an argument that simply goes, if God made something this good that is kind of works with our body so well, why would he deny us it? You know, that's an argument. I'm not saying it's the best argument, but it's an argument. What would you say to that, Greg?
Well, it just reminds me of, like, a guy I know is a pothead, and it's like, if God didn't want me to smoke a lot of pot, why would he make it so enjoyable? If God didn't want us to eat it, why would he make it so tasty? I don't think that's a terribly good argument. If you're asking, you know, why is it possible for us to eat meat and benefit from it if God didn't want it that way, I'd go back to my accommodation argument, that there's a lot of things that God accommodates, given this fallen world and stuff. And we got to be okay with that. And people are at different places in their spiritual walk. And that's why we can't be legalistic about this. And that's why the New Testament forbids being legalistic about this. And so we have to each follow our own calling. But I think it's... as much as possible, though it's permitted, sometimes God calls us to a higher thing. Paul says all things are permissible, but not all things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. And so, I find that, you know, one of the things that I haven't mentioned this yet, but the things that that concern me, it's another factor in this, is that I think violence desensitizes us to violence. And you know, Pythagoras said this in the 6th century BC. He says, any civilization that allows for the killing of animals will eventually be allowing for the killing of each other, or will find themselves killing each other. He's catching on that violence tends to be contagious. And I found that just cutting it off at the root and not conceding any of it, it makes you more sensitive to the violence around you. But also opens your eyes to see a beauty that you haven't seen before. You see things for their intrinsic worth rather than just for their utility. Cow's not just good for this; it's got its own kind of intrinsic beauty. And so, given how, especially here in America, our culture is so incredibly violent, and it's escalating because we just get desensitized to it. And so, I think the more we can do to sensitize ourselves to violence, the better. And purging, for me, it's a carte blanche. I want to purge it all from my life, and I've just found it to be one of the most significant decisions I ever made in terms of adjusting my own presence in the world, my own way of being in the world, my own way of seeing in the world. This purging of violence has just been absolutely essential, and I'm still in process on it. But I think it's a journey that, however people apply it, I would encourage them to accept that principle.
Yeah. Joshua, do you reject the idea that there is violence essentially involved in eating meat?
Well, no, I don't. But, you know, let's define the term violence. Now, this could lead us into a huge discussion, especially since I'm speaking with Greg Boyd and, author of The Crucifixion of the Warrior God. You know, he said quite a lot about violence and taken, you know, I do believe there is a principle of nonviolence within Christianity. Without trying to go down a path that would take us far away from food, I would say Greg probably takes that principle of nonviolence and has a much broader application that transcends many categories, and how he applies that in a way that I would not work out that same application. I acknowledge there is a nonviolent principle in Scripture, but to me it has a certain category. And taking that to the realm of, well, let's say, you know, not killing an animal to eat meat would, for me, be taking it beyond the category that the Bible actually lays it out for. Just, you know, to pick, there probably could be other examples, but that would maybe be a different discussion. If him and I ever had dinner one day and he had a salad and I had my steak, we could talk about all those other things. I would be hard-pressed to have historical examples that vegetarians or vegans are necessarily more nonviolent. I was just going through a book by Eugene Cho. No, Eugene Bach on, you know, the history of China. And one thing they just ironically they mentioned was that in the early church, one large group of missionaries were annihilated by this, Chinese vegan or vegetarian sect, you know, completely wiped out and martyred by these Chinese vegetarians, which I thought was funny because I knew this debate was coming up. But I don't know. A lot of the, you know, the Roman statesmen, vegetarianism and veganism was popular among some of the Roman thinkers, you know, but they were also involved in some pretty bloody, violent behavior as well. So I think it would take a lot to make a case that vegans and vegetarians are always less violent than meat eaters.
Hitler was a teetotaling vegetarian. So
Hitler was a vegetarian. There you go. I win. That's debate over. Hitler was a vegetarian.
But you would agree, would you, Joshua, I think it's kind of self-evident that violence desensitizes you to violence.
I know you think that, Greg, but you have a whole, you know, fundamental view of violence that's a little bit different than, to put it moderately, would you say some of your beliefs about violence is a little bit different than how some other Christians see the issue?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So, but then we're going to get into a philosophy of violence that I think could take us very far from the subject of food.
We can keep it simple enough.
The answer is no, I don't. I don't.
You don't what?
I don't agree with that premise.
When you kill a cow because you enjoy the taste of it, how is that not violent?
No, I'm not saying there's not a type of violence to that, but it's the idea that if you have that because I have a cow killed or I kill a cow or hunt my own food, therefore I'm more likely to go out and kill somebody else.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's not that simple.
That violence of one type always necessarily leads to violence of another type. You know, there are types of violence that are permissible and that are good even, that have a redemptive value to it. Now, you might not agree with that, but I would say that there are types of violence that that are beneficial.
Yeah, I would agree when you're in a situation where it's necessary and it's beneficial because you like the taste of it. If that's the benefit and you get the protein from it and stuff. But if possible to avoid it, why should I kill an animal because I enjoy it? It just seems like – but that's me talking here. Okay, I don't want to kill anything if I can avoid it. Why should I? I didn't create it. If it's necessary, I will, but it seems to me that it's more honoring to it to say, I'm not going to eat you.
Sure. But you would say, you know, if you were to take a survey, it would be difficult to say that hunters, people who go out and hunt their own food, be it turkey or deer, that they are not necessarily more likely to go out and shoot their next door neighbor.
No, I don't think that they're more likely to go shoot their neighbor.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Though they might be desensitized in other ways towards violence.
I mean, this takes us slightly off topic just at the very end of the show. But, you know, some of my non-Christian friends who are vegans, they do it for very not obviously for any biblical reason, but because they actually believe any sentient life essentially has a similar kind of value to human life. And so, you know, the Peter Singers of this world would say, actually, you might be better off saving the burning building full of pigs than the one burning building with one child inside it, because there's a sort of value. Now, do you, Greg, in any way like trade off the kind of value of animal life over human life, or would you say no, human life always trumps?
No, I think that I have friends who are these radical egalitarians where all life is equal, and that strikes me as not just impractical but absurd. If a house is on fire, I love my dog to death. I love my dog. But if I have to choose between my daughter and my dog, I'm going to go for my daughter. I think there's more worth there. I think Jesus died for all creation, but that doesn't mean all creation has equal worth. And so we're made in the image of God, and we're the only ones that are said to have that title. And so I think there's an honor there that there's a hierarchy there. But the hierarchy is as much as possible to be governed with compassion, love, and gentleness, and then to having a power over, and I have rights over you, and therefore I can't.
Sure.
I think that's the difference of the kingdom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I was just interested to hear what your perspective would be on that. I mean, presumably, Joshua, you broadly agree with that, the idea of a hierarchy. And presumably, in your view, it does, and we'll kind of start to end here. It does, though, give a sense of there is a right that humans have to animal life, you know, as part of the natural order of you know, food and the life cycle and so on.
And I'm only saying that you don't have to exercise that right, and you might want to consider not exercising that right. You might find that it opens up things for you that wouldn't otherwise be opened up. That's all I'm saying.
I appreciate that, Greg. Thank you.
You have the right. I bless you.
Thank you.
Well, I would love to sit down for a meal of whatever type with both of you one day to hash this out more, but we're going to have to leave it here for now. Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you so much, Joshua.
Ben, a pleasure.
I should have mentioned your websites already, but I'll make sure they're with the show so people can click through. You can find out more about Greg at renew.org, that's renew with a K, or whchurch.org for the church, Woodland Hills, that Greg ministers at. Joshua D. Jones, at Blue Cheese Whiskey, if you want to follow him on Twitter. I'll make sure there's a way you can do that from today's show. And you might want to check out his books as well. That includes was it A Brief Biblical Theology of Meat? There you go. You're holding
meat,
up to the camera.
A Brief. It's only about 65 pages. Meat, A Brief Biblical Theology. Have a lot of this information on it.
All right. Well, look, it's been great to have you both on. Greg and Joshua, thanks for being with
thanks
me.
Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Joshua.
Nice meeting you, Joshua.
If you want to get in touch about today's show, I do welcome your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also tell me what you thought on our social media, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow us on Facebook. And there are other ways to get in touch with me as well and see what I'm up to. Instagram and TikTok, Justin.Briley are the places to go. Just a quick reminder before we get to your feedback that Genexis is coming to Coventry and London this September. It's a fantastic series of speaking events. Three consecutive nights in Coventry, the 20th, 21st and 22nd of September, and then the same thing in London, the 27th, 28th and 29th of September. Some wonderful guests who are going to be speaking: Professor Tom McLeish, Paul Davies, John Lennox, Tom Holland, Sharon Dirks, Andy Bannister, Reverend Stephen Foster and Professor N.T. Wright. So short, engaging talks on scientific, philosophical and historical questions. And it's absolutely free. So genexis.org if you want to find out more about that. And we did hear just last week from Ben Jacobs about that as well. Let's leap into some of your thoughts on recent editions of the show. First of all, psychedelics. This got a big response over on Twitter. A lot of people saying they enjoyed listening. Lindsay says, listen to this today on my walk. Very fun to see what they look like. I think you must be referring to the image we put up on the web page or on the video. Thank you for being such an open-minded, amazing host, Justin. Love the Unbelievable podcast and greatly appreciated hearing some of the most informed people discussing many questions that are important to me. This was a show in which Ashley Landy told her story of having been very much into psychedelics, but deciding to reject them and become a Christian. Peter Sherstedt Hughes was our advocate for the use of psychedelics as a pathway to spiritual enlightenment. Nate Brantley on this one said, fascinating discussion. Thank you all. I enjoyed the discussion of the use of psychedelics in different cultural contexts and ancient times. Curious to learn more about those topics. Bill Brown said, this one really hit home. I have much in common with Ashley. Especially interesting to me that her husband was interested in Eastern Orthodoxy, as I feel the tradition illustrates the spiritual realm in a way that maps with the psychedelic experience. And Aloysia tweeted, psychedelics are a very limited window in which they help. There's some work dealing with PTSD, IIRC, quitting smoking, etc. But outside of that, it's likely to confuse the issue. Basically, it's a new toy. Novelty for novelty's sake, as Peterson has remarked, beware of unearned experiences. And DLR tweets, to conjure is to conjugate. Beware of what gateways are opened when conjuring a realm beyond our comprehension, assuming it is God who is answering the compelling call. Nowhere in the New Testament do we read psychedelics were used in order to get the attention of the heavenly realm. Doug Harris asked whether we could do a podcast with Brian Murarescu, who I mentioned on the show, on the case of whether Christianity was originally a drug cult. That would be an interesting one. Thank you. And another Doug gets in touch, this time with their own personal story, Doug Cumming in Gibraltar. And he says, I'm a long-time listener to Unbelievable, highly recommended to anyone interested in courteous, sensible and profound debate. My own story with psychedelics is so similar to Ashley Landy's that I couldn't wait for the latest podcast to end so I could write to you. I too came to Christ after searching for meaning in life through LSD. In my case, it didn't happen in Haight Ashbury or California, but through the 1970s Jesus People movement in tiny Gibraltar. I totally agree with Ashley about the dangers of psychedelics. I personally know no less than three people who have been institutionalized as a result of too much LSD. I believe that had it not been for my encounter with Jesus, I would have joined them. In my acid head days, we would always advise people to take a babysitter who was not on acid with them because things can go badly wrong on a trip. I do, however, support Dr. Peter Sjersted-Hughes' positive stance on the therapeutic and metaphysical dimension to the use of psychedelics. In my experience, acid magnifies our perception of reality, sometimes admittedly to the point of distortion, and can because of this introduce us to the existence of different, including mystical realities. For people unable to break out of negative and destructive mindsets, psychedelics can be just the escape route they need. But like all escape routes, they need a guide, and when they've done their job, it must be left behind. In the spiritual realm, Dr. Peter himself acknowledges that he cannot call himself a naturalistic atheist after his experience with psychedelics. Once opened to the possibility of a deeper reality to life through psychedelics, people often go on to seek the answers in religion and philosophy. As Christians, Ashley and I have found that answer in Christ. And just to end briefly, I do have one tiny beef, Justin, with your use of the comment, getting high with the Most High. That phrase refers to getting high on Jesus or being filled with the Holy Spirit, not LSD, an infinitely better alternative to drugs. Thank you very much, Doug, in Gibraltar. And another interesting one here as well from Chris Jeffries here in the UK, who gets in touch to say, I've been a long time listener to the show, about 8 years, I think. Often thought about writing in, never got round to it, but after the debate between Ashley and Peter, felt compelled to write in. This was a great debate. One reason I found it interesting is because Ashley's story overlaps a little with mine. I spent a couple of years on the fringes of the psychedelic community, never as fully immersed in that world as Ashley was, but nevertheless felt a lot of overlap on my journey to faith. Looking back, I can see one positive aspect of dabbling in psychedelic drugs was that it got me searching for something deeper and more meaningful, a kind of spiritual yearning which ultimately led me to finding faith in Christ almost 40 years ago now. But the experience itself I found hollow and empty. I think Ashley described it well when she said it's like an idol, attractive on the outside but empty on the inside. But I think her point, which really hit the nail on the head, was when she said that the one thing lacking in that experience was the essence of Christianity, being love the Lord with all your heart, soul, strength and mind. Not just that, but also to love your neighbour as yourself. And for me, the essence of this statement, reflecting the fact that everyone is created in the image of God and therefore has intrinsic value, is decidedly lacking from the psychedelic culture and worldview. Ashley referenced the various books from that era, including Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. I remember reading that book, and one thing really bothered me. There was a character in the community who they named Bad Vibes, and at one point they kicked him off the bus. I remember reading that at the time and thinking, does no one care for him? What if that was me? It seemed to me that the psychedelic community was a great place to be if you're cool, but if you're not cool, you get kicked off the bus and there's no place for you. There is a communal consciousness, but not everyone is allowed to join. One of the most famous quotes from the book is, you're either on the bus or you're off. That seems to me to be a world apart from life in Christ, where everyone's accepted with open arms, cool or not. The unconditional acceptance which Christianity has to offer is a million miles from the culture which that book and the cultural movement around that time promoted, which to me seems exclusive and elitist. I'm sure Peter is right. There were many good things which came out of that culture, the peace movement, concern for the environment, etc. But for me, there's something unique in the way that Christianity offers an utterly unconditional love and acceptance, which in our own strength we are incapable of finding, incapable even with the help of mind-expanding drugs. Love the show, consistently high-quality debates on a huge diversity of subjects, and this one was no exception. Thank you so much, Chris. Great to hear from you. A number of other interesting responses as well to this show. Let's go to Dr. Mark Logata, who says, first of all, thanks for the amazing discussions. Your last two guests were both lovely. I can tell both their hearts were in the right place, but I've got to be honest, When Ashley Landy was presented with scientific evidence that psychedelics may have some beneficial effects, she responded that no one she knows had any benefits. Unfortunately, that's akin to me saying I don't know anyone who's had severe effects from COVID, so it mustn't be that dangerous. Usually, the way to challenge a data set that doesn't agree with your position is to present more compelling evidence, and then the other party recognises the quality of the evidence and changes their practice, something I do as a doctor very often. She's very gracious and well-spoken, but I think maybe was out of her depth when commenting on the scientific literature. As a medical doctor, I can attest that there is a growing body of evidence that there are long-term benefits for psychedelics for treatment of anxiety, depression, OCD, PTSD, etc. Are psychedelics safe for everyone? No. Should scientific investigation continue in the hopes of helping our fellow human beings? Undoubtedly. I'd love to learn more on Unbelievable about God and psychedelics, as the medical literature seems to suggest that the subjects report these experiences as important spiritual events. From what I've read, often Christians who have been through these psychedelic experiences will have experienced a reaffirmation of their faith. Thank you very much, Dr. Mark Legata, for being in touch. Ben Schmittiel says, Ashley Land, amazing lady, obviously a very unusual person, but I was impressed with her grasp of Christian truth, which she repeatedly returned to when not directly replying to Peter's challenges. It's unfortunate she didn't remain within the scriptural admonitions against the use of drugs and alcohol. Most of the episode, Peter and she were arguing on Peter's grounds rather than on scriptural grounds. I don't think it's actually even debatable that long-term use of psychedelics has negative consequences. But without either professional credentials or ready statistics, she was not really equipped to debate with him and was stuck with only personal experiences to refute his claims. It did seem that once Peter realised she was not going to hold him accountable for his statements, he became excessively aggressive. Still, it was an interesting episode. I think you should keep Ashley in mind for future shows. Thank you very much, Ben. Yes, and Ashley wanted to say really from the outset that she wasn't coming to this as someone who, you know, has a degree in the subject or anything like that. She's coming from her own personal experience, but also her own research into the area. And actually, I thought in various respects, she did hold her own when it came to looking at some of the studies that Peter referenced and that kind of thing in support of his case. But I thought it was, personally, I just found it a fascinating discussion to host. And perhaps we'll do more of those sorts of slightly out there esoteric kind of discussions, but where obviously there's a lot of interest in people looking at these things from a Christian and non-Christian perspective. Maybe we've just time to squeeze in a few more emails, and we're going to go to some of the ones that came in a little while ago now. The end of August, Christine Kobe Dumay would join me for a live stream. So this was just a one-to-one with Christine on the issue of masculinity in the church, the evangelical church, and talking through issues like Trump and Driscoll and other things, all on the basis of her book, Jesus and John Wayne. Varied responses, mixed bag, I've got to say, in terms of how you reacted to that one. For instance, Steve Hackman, on the one hand, tweeted, Justin, I've been listening to your interviews for about 10 years, and I'd put this one in the top five. If Christine's response to your question about whether there is a biblical masculinity was embraced by the American church, a lot of healing could take place. And similarly, Thomas emailed in, this is Thomas B. Yee, who's a composer and music theorist, and said, been a while since I last wrote, but felt compelled to share my gratitude and thoughts on that episode. I want to express that the episode on evangelical masculinity with Christine was the most important and impactful, unbelievable episode aired in my 7+ years of listening. In many ways, I felt that Christine's research was describing my experience and journey in evangelical churches. Her expose of the social effects of evangelical masculinity explains much of that past decade of American history. Christianity must grapple with its idolization of hegemonic masculinity to become a credible witness in today's world. My only disappointment was that Christine's editors cut her chapter on alternative masculinity. Her own and my own academic work researches, among other things, the representations of hegemonic masculinity and alternative masculinity in video game music. Gaming culture, like evangelical culture, has suffered from a history of hegemonic masculinity that's now starting to wrestle with. Thanks for hosting such a relevant conversation. Hope there will be other episodes on this topic. Thank you, Thomas. Glad to see you emailing in again. That was on the positive side. On the not so positive side, people like Brandon getting in touch to say, I'm a Reformed Christian, like Mrs. Dumais and like her, would not identify as an evangelical. I was pleased, though, she made the distinction between the theological definition of evangelical and the sociological movement called evangelicalism. But I find it strange that her views on evangelical votes for Trump as evidence of an unhealthy masculine Christianity, as if these same evangelicals did not vote for the mild-mannered Mitt Romney, as if one party is not fully devoted to allowing the murder of pre-born humans. No, evangelicals chose Trump because the Democrat Party ostentatiously flaunts an anti-Christian worldview. I can understand why secular leftists have a motivation to link evangelical Christianity with the brash and immoral Donald Trump, but Christians ought to be more discerning. That being said, it doesn't invalidate her claim that American evangelicalism has had an unhealthy view of masculinity. However, voting for Trump isn't evidence for that claim. Great show, thank you, says Brandon in Baton Rouge. Brian gets in touch and says, hi, Justin, listener of the podcast. Thank you for the quality debates. But I'm disappointed that Kristen didn't have a countervailing opinion presented alongside hers. Normally, when you bring individuals on the show, you bring someone on who challenges the perspective. Here, I find that Kristen's attacks on Christian masculinity conveniently feed into the leftist propaganda and cultural attacks on traditional culture. And while I'm happy to listen to discussions on those ideas, I find it alarming they were presented so straightforwardly on your program without an examination of the flaws or responses to the argument by another guest. And in similar light, this one from Matthew Boland in Midland, Texas, said, Justin, I'm terribly vexed. I just listened to the Christine episode, and if I'm honest, I feel attacked. There were a few things Christian said that I could agree with, but in general, I felt like she was disparaging and mischaracterized many of the values I hold dear. My father and many of the men in my community were greatly blessed by the Promise Keepers movement. It was a good thing that God used to work a lot of good in a lot of lives. I myself have been richly blessed by the ministry of John Eldridge and Wild at Heart for my entire adult life. It's a good thing that God has used to do a lot of good in countless lives. So to characterize those ministries as toxic, yes, I know she was careful not to use that word, but that's exactly what she's implying, is a major mischaracterization that borders on sensationalism. Has she ever read or listened to any of John Eldridge's work? You'll have to paint with a very broad brush to get John Eldridge and Mark Driscoll in the same camp. Give me a break. And besides that, Christians seem to be operating on the assumption that men and women are exactly alike and no special work needs to be done to evangelize and disciple men in our churches. I think the Jordan Peterson phenomenon has been sweeping through secular circles and proves that men resonate and respond to things differently than women do. Men are seeking for something that recognizes and celebrates their uniqueness, just as women are. Doesn't Christian recognize that men and women both bear the image of God in their own special way? Anyway, you go on to give some other suggestions for the program, and yes, just lots of helpful thoughts as well. Matthew, thank you very much. And you're not the only one who felt like that as well. I'll just read one more from Scott Nickel, teaching pastor at Southland Christian Church, who said, I must say, after listening to that one, it would be helpful to have someone debate Kristen if she'd be willing. I've listened to her on the podcast about Mars Hill as well. And so far, I found her work to misrepresent biblical masculinity, but also mischaracterize those who are calling men to it. As someone who's been a pastor for over 20 years in rather large churches, I understand some of her critique, but also find it shallow. For example, Bill Hybels represented not only an egalitarian theological perspective, but the church perhaps most responsible for egalitarian models being adopted by a lot of other churches. The influence of Willow Creek and its association is extraordinary. Has she critiqued Dr. Bill Zakian, who both Hybels and Willow put forward as the theological expert on behalf of this perspective? She makes it sound like all abuses of power by male pastors are birthed out of a complementarian perspective and have a cause and effect relationship. Now, that's not only not true, but lazy representation. I think it would be helpful for your listeners if you provided an opportunity for dialogue. Anyway, thank you very much. All of those heard. And yes, it wasn't to be that we did it in a dialogue format on this occasion, but who knows? We may try and cover the subject at least again in a dialogue format in the future. But always interested in hearing your responses, both your praise and your constructive criticism for the show. It's all goes into the pot. Thanks for being with me on today's edition of the show. Look forward to hearing your responses on veganism as well, and we'll try and read as many of those out in a future edition of the program as we can. Lots of exciting things on the boil for Unbelievable. Soon going to be telling you about the launch of new YouTube channels from our wider umbrella of Unbelievable for our NT Wright show and our C.S. Lewis podcast. Plus, we are on the verge of putting out publicly our very first online apologetics course from Unbelievable as well. Lots of exciting stuff in the pipeline. So thanks for being with us on today's edition of the program, and let me tell you what's coming up next time. Well, it's another ethical debate for you. Should those who are terminally ill or in chronic pain be allowed to end their lives? A new bill on assisted dying is being debated in the UK Parliament soon. We'll be looking at it from both sides. Rabbi Jonathan Romain believes people should be given the right to end their own life. Mark Pickering from the Christian Medical Fellowship says assisted dying isn't good for patients or doctors. We'll be debating it this time next week. See you then.